Good morning, everybody, as we're finding our seats for the remainder of the session. Just wanted to say that my upbringing was obviously different than Dr. Burns, who was educated in the nuances of end-of-life care. All I was taught when I was a child is that I had to be a doctor. Nothing else was... They tell the story of a medical student who approached his professor after the grades were in. And he told his professor, "I want you to know, professor, if my doctor ever tells me that I have 1 hour to live, I want to spend that hour in your classroom." So the professor was very honored. He said, "Of all the places in the world, why in my classroom?" So he said, "Because an hour with you, professor, seems like an eternity." Now, I hope we won't feel that for this session in particular, but this hour of life, the hour at the end of life, can gain us an eternity. The Chazal tell us that Adam kone olamo b'shoah achas. One can indeed be kone, obtain the world to come in that 1 hour. And it is those final minutes, those final hours, those final days that we spend a great deal of time talking about. And it's interesting because the medical community says that a tremendous amount of financial effort is expended on the last few days of life, a disproportionate amount of financial effort. We likewise, but positively, spend a disproportionate effort in halachic discussions about the end of life. But for us, it's not something that we consider negative, we actually consider positive. I turn your attention to this cartoon, which reads on the bottom, there's a man coming to one of the ministering angels of God after he's ended his life in this world. And he says on the bottom, "Sorry I'm late, but they had me on life support system for 2 months." So the question that I want to address really is this the Jewish point of view or is this not the Jewish point of view? And really my objective this morning in our session is to synthesize the two wonderful presentations that preceded me, to synthesize the presentation of Dr. Burns, who laid out the clinical questions. It's always a schus to share the podium with Dr. Burns. I hope to do so, Yitzhak Hashem, for many years to come. And the wonderful and thoughtful and detailed analysis of Rabbi Dr. Shabtai, and to bring it into the clinical context and share with you some clinical pearls about how to apply these issues in the real world in the walls of the hospital. My objectives are, first, to understand the medical issues that pertain to end-of-life care. Secondly, to appreciate the medical and cultural milieu in which medical decisions are made. And that's perhaps most important. And thirdly, to facilitate psak halacha for end-of-life issues. And we're going to deal with the same issues that Dr. Burns laid out for us this morning. The DNR, DNI, general withholding of care, the comatose patient and PBS, which stands for persistent vegetative state, nutrition and hydration, disconnecting.
DNI.
Oh, I will explain. Thank you for asking. The question is, what is DNI? So I will explain. All initials will be explained, fear not. Disconnecting a ventilator, pain management at the end of life, and active euthanasia. We begin, like we often do in the medical community, with our case studies. Mr. B. Cohn, 66 years old. These are all based on real-life cases that I have encountered in the emergency department. Mr. B. Cohn, 66 years old, is a chronic smoker who was recently diagnosed with lung cancer. He has completed chemotherapy with no improvement, and further therapy is deemed futile. He now presents to the hospital with shortness of breath. The hospital staff asks the family if they wish to sign a DNR. The Cohn family calls the rabbi and asks, "Can we sign a DNR, Rabbi?" And this line is a key line, probably one of the most important lines for our discussion today. The rabbi then calls the doctor to discuss the case. Now, decision-making at the end of life for us, as Torah-observant Jews, is really a triad, or quadrat, perhaps. There are a number of people that are involved in this decision-making. Very often, in the medical circumstance, it's the patient and the physician alone. The patient, the physician, and the patient's family. There's a very important factor in our decision-making, and that is the rabbi. End-of-life decision-making needs to be done almost invariably with rabbinic oversight and rabbinic input. And that's why, to be perfectly honest, in general, I'm extremely hesitant to speak about end-of-life issues in a public forum, because I have tremendous trepidation that someone will walk away from these discussions and think they could apply these discussions to real-life circumstances. I must hasten to add that under no circumstances should anything we discuss today be applied to any clinical case without discussion with a competent POSIC. But what is absolutely essential also is not that the rabbi hear about the case peripherally. If this is a real end-of-life case, the rabbi needs to dialogue with the physician, his or herself. And it's absolutely essential to have that dialogue, because patients' perception of their medical illness is very often not in touch with reality. So if you have to ask the patient or the family what the medical condition is, the way they relay it to the rabbi may indeed not be the actual clinical case. So it's absolutely essential to close that loop and have the rabbi dialogue with the physician directly. So the question was asked, what does DNI mean? So many people are familiar with the DNR. I mean, I assume everybody, just by show of hands, everybody here is familiar with what DNR stands for and what DNR is. So DNR stands for Do Not Resuscitate. And I think by law, hospitals are required to inform you of your ability to make that decision for any hospital admission. If you come in for a toe infection, they're going to give you a form that says, do you want to be a DNR? Every hospital admission necessitates this form. DNR means that if, Rahmanul Islan, the person's heart stops beating, they stop breathing, no resuscitation will be done. No resuscitation, no compressions on the chest, no putting in a breathing machine, no resuscitation will be done. There's another aspect of end-of-life care called DNI. DNI, which is an extremely important document also, is a document that says that if the patient requires to be put on a breathing machine, that you do not wish to be put on a breathing machine. Now, this does not need to be a case of cessation of heartbeat or cessation of, it's not a full cardiac arrest. Someone comes in, has difficulty breathing, so you can stipulate, I do not want to be intubated. The I stands for intubation, which is to put somebody in a breathing machine. Put somebody in a breathing machine. And one of the things which I want to share with you, which is extremely important, we talked about pure halacha, we talk about pure medicine, but I need to share with you the cultural milieu of the hospital. The cultural milieu of the hospital today, in the 21st century, has evolved into a culture of non-treatment. What does that mean? That means that physicians and healthcare workers are extremely comfortable with not treating patients at the end of life, not only allowing patients to die, but facilitating the death of patients, which is very much in contrast with halacha's approach to the preservation of life as much as possible within the halachic parameters. So many times, you will be confronted with physicians or nurses or staff who have different perspectives than you do. And the reason I mention this is because of these kinds of manifestations in the hospital. Here's just one article of dozens of articles. This is from the American Geriatric Society. The effect of do not resuscitate orders on physician-patient decision-making. The effect of do not resuscitate orders on physicians' decisions to provide life-prolonging treatments other than cardiopulmonary resuscitation for patients near the end of life was explored. The presence of a DNR order may affect physicians' willingness to order a variety of treatments not related to CPR. Patients with DNR orders may choose to forego other life-prolonging treatments, but physicians should elicit additional information about patients' treatment goals to inform these decisions. What does this mean? This means when you sign a do not resuscitate order, which may be perfectly halachically appropriate, that if the heart stops not to be resuscitated, the medical community often perceives that as a general philosophical approach to your end-of-life care, that you don't want anything done to preserve your life. And you need to make it patently clear to the medical staff that if you want a do not resuscitate order, that it is restricted to a do not resuscitate order specifically, and it does not mean that you don't want other therapies which may be appropriate from a halachic perspective. We talked about these quality of life issues from Rabbi Reis and Rabbi Dr. Shabtai mentioned this remarkable case of Yehuda Hanasi, of the Amsa Rebbe, of the maid of Rabbi Yehuda. And the other case, which was also mentioned by Rabbi Dr. Shabtai, the Ran in Nedarim, which actually says that it is indeed permitted to be mispalel, to pray for someone's life to end. And he actually says that when you are mevaker cholim, you visit someone who is sick, you can provide them an essential service. And he says that part of that service is to attend to their physical needs. And he also says that if you neglect from performing bikur cholim in person, you might actually deprive the person of the opportunity to pray for their death. Because if you go visit them and you see how severe the illness is and how much they are suffering, you might be motivated to be mispal el shiyamus, to pray that they should die, and that would be an advantage for the patient, that would be a benefit for the patient. If you don't perform the bikur cholim, you might deprive them of that specific benefit. So we see there is clearly a sensitivity to the fact in halacha that while life is of infinite value, and this is the dialectic that Dr. Burns laid out from the beginning and Rabbi Reese laid out so beautifully at the beginning, there's a dialectic between the infinite value of life, yet life is not worth perpetuating at all costs, especially if there is extraordinary suffering for the patient. There's another classic source mentioned in the Yalkut Shimoni, which reflects this notion. And it's the story of a woman that became extremely old, and she went to Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta and said, "Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta, I don't want to live anymore. What should I do?" So he said to her, "To what do you attribute your longevity?" And she said, "I go to shul every single day. I've never missed a davening in my life." So Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta says to her, "Absent yourself from shul for 3 days." On the third day, she passed. Here again, a sensitivity to the fact that life is of great value, but there are times indeed when life may not be worth living for the individual. So what are the halakhic issues that are discussed with respect to the end-of-life care of patients? Is it ever permitted to withhold or withdraw care? If yes, what is the halakhic framework for withholding? And this was beautifully discussed by Rabbi Dr. Shabtai. How is a goses defined, bisman hazeh? How is a goses defined today? Does this definition have practical halachic application? Again, beautifully discussed by Dr. Shabtai. Are the wishes of the patient taken into consideration? Can a family member decide on behalf of a patient who has no decision-making capacity? So these are obviously extremely, extremely important issues. The framework which has been applied to end-of-life decision-making is the halachic issue of the goses, and also a framework applied by Moshe Feinstein, Zatzal. If a patient is in intractable suffering, indeed it can be permitted, and he even says, not only permitted to withhold care, you may actually be mechuyev, obligated to withhold care, so as not to prolong the life that is in suffering. The opposing position mentioned by my predecessors, the other extreme position, is that of the Tzitz Eliezer, who holds that suffering is of innate value philosophically and theologically, and one should continue treatment despite the fact that the patient is suffering, and continue at all costs. This is a minority position, not so much applied clinically. Which specific treatments should be withheld, can be withheld? Patients receive antibiotics, blood transfusions, pressors, which are medications to sustain blood pressure, dialysis. I specifically do not tell you details about which can and which cannot be withheld. My objective is to share with you that discussions need to be had about all of these types of treatments, when and if they can be withheld, and under what circumstances. There are two existing documents now in the Jewish world for decision-making at the end of life. There's the RCA Living Will and the Aguda Healthcare Proxy. A number of years ago, we actually revised the document of the RCA Living Will, and the objective of that revision was multiple. How many people here are familiar with the RCA Living Will? How many people here are familiar with the Aguda Living Will? Here also, I need to share with you some important clinical experience. Documents of the past, for those of you who filled out living wills in the past 10 years ago, 15 years ago, they were very detailed oriented documents. They would give you scenarios. If I would be in scenario A, then I want X, Y, and Z done. If I would be in scenario B, then I want these things done. And literally detailed all these different scenarios. And you would have to sit and really prophetically determine if I were to be involved in one of these scenarios, what would I do? The problem with these scenarios is that it was difficult for the patient to interpret the scenario, and it was also difficult for the doctor to interpret if the clinical situation was identical with the scenario or not identical with the scenario. So the medical community began to realize that this document is not such a helpful document. And to be honest, as a physician in the emergency room, I was encountered with these documents, and I will tell you one thing, which is quite frightening, is that it depends which physician is on call that day as to how the document will be interpreted. Now, I will tell you, if you're a lawyer, that's not the kind of document you want to sign. A document is going to be interpreted differently if I happen to be in the emergency room or if my colleague happens to be in the emergency room. So what we shifted to in the RCA Living Will, and is clearly much more effective in terms of end-of-life decision care and decision-making, is in essence a healthcare proxy. And a healthcare proxy is an individual that you choose to make your decisions at the end of life, someone to whom you have stipulated what your concerns are and what your issues are and what your likes and dislikes are. And the assumption is that that person will dialogue with the rabbi in the appropriate circumstance to make the decisions at the end of life. Now, a major, major distinction between the healthcare proxy of the secular world and the healthcare proxy of the non-of the Jewish world. The premise that underlies the documents in the secular world, the living will, the healthcare proxy, is the notion of autonomy. Autonomy means that the individual rules their body and can make a decision in any way, shape, or form of every aspect of care. To resuscitate, to not resuscitate, to give medicines, to not give medicines, to give nutrition, to not give nutrition. The document of halacha is not fundamentally different, but the theological underpinnings are different. Because in halacha, halacha does not subscribe to the notion of autonomy. Not in its classic sense. According to halacha, the body does not belong to the individual. We don't have a right to commit suicide, Rahman al-Son. We don't have a right to cause bodily harm to ourselves. Our bodies belong to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we are guardians of that body. Indeed, there are many circumstances where we can make decisions to withhold care. But there may be circumstances where halacha dictates that care has to be delivered despite the objections of the patient. So therefore, it is a fundamentally different document than that of halacha. So take nutrition and hydration, which we'll get to again in a moment. But again, depending on the psak and depending on the circumstance, there may be cases where if a patient refuses nutrition and hydration, but a posik might say nutrition and hydration has to be given over the objections of the patient. So that's something which is essential in interpretation of these kinds of documents. I just wanted to discuss also another important difference in the application of these end-of-life issues amongst the poskim to the patient who is comatose or in a persistent vegetative state. Excuse me one moment. How many people here are familiar with the Terry Schiavo case? So the Terry Schiavo case, this tombstone, for those of you who followed the case, was written by her husband, not by her parents. Epitaph for Terry Schiavo, Schiavo Teresa Marie, born December 3rd, 1963, departed this earth February 25th, 1990. That's when she had her cardiac arrest and fell into a persistent vegetative state. At peace, March 31st, 2005. So this is clearly not a halachically based tombstone. Because we believe that even the comatose patient has a full status of life, 1,000%, as anybody sitting in this room, and I hope nobody in this room is comatose at this particular time. From the medical perspective, does a comatose patient experience pain? Now, if you look at the diagnosis of stupor and coma, for those of you who have done any medical studies in Plum and Posner's classic work, it's literally about this thick. So coma, we're not going to discuss the medical details of coma. Coma is a whole spectrum of conditions. There is no one coma. There's a whole spectrum of coma. Also, I must hasten to add that coma is not synonymous with brain death. Brain death is a very distinct neurological diagnosis, which is not... Although originally it was called irreversible coma, there is a very specific diagnosis of brain death, which, and it's not generally associated with coma. And thirdly, a comatose patient per se does not necessarily have a terminal condition. So Terry Schiavo did not have any terminal condition from which she would have died. She did live for many, many years in her condition and could have lived a number of more years had her nutrition and hydration not been withheld. What are the halachic issues that relate to these patients? Because many patients at the end of life are unconscious, are comatose. Do we differentiate in these kinds of scenarios? Is a comatose patient treated differently in the eyes of halacha? Is a comatose patient considered to be suffering from intractable pain such that treatments may be withheld, which is the shita of Moshe Feinstein Zatzal? His framework of ability to withhold care was intractable pain, is suffering. Is such a patient suffering? Perhaps this patient's not suffering, and you wouldn't have a license to withhold treatment because the patient experiences no pain. And third is the requirement for food or to treat infections different for the comatose patient. Now, Moshe Feinstein very importantly says, "Devadai pashtu borov yadua l'chol ben torav yirei shamayim, shemchuyovin l'rapos l'hatzil b'mash efshar l'chol odom b'lo shum chiluk b'chachmoso v'data." So we don't differentiate between any human being from the beginning of life to end of life, no matter what their intellectual capability, no matter what their debility, they're all treated equally in the eyes of halacha. But his license to treat for patients that are suffering severe and intractable pain, does this apply to a patient who is comatose? And Moshe Feinstein says, "Umashu yomru harofim," with respect to the comatose patient, maybe physicians will tell you that neurologically, once a patient becomes comatose, they no longer experience pain. They're no longer sentient. Ein l'ha'aminam, should not be believed. Yevshar lo shayach sheyed uze. D'hamash m'sheikuv yitzias ha'nefesh hu b'yisurin af shelo nikarlan. So I guess there's a number of ways to interpret this, but for our purposes, I guess we'll say that there is at least an existential pain for someone who is in coma. So Rav Moshe is basically saying that all those permissions to withhold care under halachic guidance and with specific discussion that could be applied to patients who are conscious and awake and suffering should equally be applied to patients who are comatose and who are not suffering. But Rav Yashiv should have before Shlema differs with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Yashiv actually says, in somewhat of an ironic fashion, that he also maintains in certain circumstances one can withhold treatment from a conscious patient when the patient is experiencing tremendous suffering. But if that patient becomes comatose and is no longer experiencing pain, then the license to withhold treatment no longer applies, and you have to be more aggressive to treat the comatose patient than the non-comatose patient, including resuscitation. That's what Rav Yashiv says. Just to share with you some fascinating developments in medicine that directly impact on this machlokas between Rav Moshe and Rav Yashiv. Over the last 10 years, and there are a number of articles have arisen, a number of studies are being done on patients who are perceived to be comatose with no communicative ability with the outside world. And the tests that are now being applied in fascinating studies, and this is one from, this is already back in 2006, detecting awareness in the vegetative state, and this one, which is a review of the literature in the New England Journal, February 2010, in an article entitled "Willful Modulation of Brain Activity and Disorders of Consciousness." I think they need people to work on their titles. It's not a very catchy, title. But just to translate what this means, is that they take patients who are thought to be comatose with no human interaction whatsoever, and they take patients who are conscious, and they subject both of them to imaging studies called functional MRI. Now, what's a functional MRI? An MRI or a CAT scan or an X-ray is a static test. It's a picture. A functional MRI is a movie, and they can see the brain in motion, in action. And they ask patients while they're sitting in a chair, the conscious patients, if you were to be walking around your room at home, what would you do? Or imagine yourself playing tennis. And while they're sitting in their chair, the frontal cortex of the brain starts to light up as if they were playing tennis. They imagine themselves swinging the racket, their backhand, their forehand, whatever the case may be. And they subjected these comatose patients to the same exact questions. Lo and behold, they found out that a percentage of these patients who were thought to have no communicative ability whatsoever are now actually able to respond to these questions, and their brains light up exactly as the controls light up. And what number are we talking about? We're talking about 1 in 1,000,000? Of the 54 patients enrolled in the study, 5 were able to willfully modulate their brain activity. 5 out of 54. Now, obviously, this has direct relevance to the Piskei Halacha of Rav Eliashiv and Rav Moshe in terms of the ability to assess for the patient's perception and pain perception. One of these patients in that study was comatose for 23 years, and they thought they had no communicative ability. Now that patient is able to communicate with their family through sophisticated technology where they can communicate through eyelid movements and a computer. Nutrition and hydration. Mr. C. Cohn has been suffering from progressive dementia. His oral intake has declined, and he is now refusing to eat entirely. He often recognizes family. There are good days and bad days. He has no acute medical conditions. And the family says, do we have to insert a feeding tube? He's not able to eat anymore. This is one of the most commonly asked questions. What are the halachic issues? What are the scientific issues? This is a nasogastric tube, a tube which goes into the nose, which is only a temporary solution. This is the so-called feeding tube, the PEG, or percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy, which goes directly into the stomach. Does one need to do these kinds of things? Is nutrition and hydration...
Is that an intubation? Is that...
No. Excellent question. Intubation is putting a plastic tube into the throat, which goes directly into the lungs. This plastic tube goes from the outside wall into the stomach. Goes directly into the stomach, so food can be administered directly into the gastric cavity. Is nutrition and hydration considered supportive care or medical treatment that can be withheld? Is the method of nutrition relevant? Is the prognosis of the patient relevant? Are the wishes of the patient relevant? There are a wide variety of piskei halacha. The general approach is that nutrition and hydration are considered supportive care that is essential delivered to every individual. Are there circumstances where it's okay to withhold nutrition? Yes, there are, but that's going to be clearly a case-by-case basis. Are there circumstances where nutrition can be detrimental to the patient? So I just got called on a case last week of a woman with end-stage cancer that the administration of fluid in her feeding tube is causing more distress for her, more harmful for her, and in that case, you know, clearly nutrition can be withheld. And again, every single case has to be addressed with a POSIC. Can one disconnect the life support? Here you have somebody sitting in front of the television, and the wife says, do I have the patient's consent to switch off the life support system? Can one disconnect the ventilator? Mrs. D. Cohn suffers from high blood pressure, diabetes, congestive heart failure. They've tried to take her off the respirator unsuccessfully. The family says, can we disconnect the ventilator? Here again, in the cultural milieu that we live in, when I trained as a resident, if you wanted to disconnect somebody from a respirator, you had to get a court order to disconnect them from a respirator. Now, it is extremely commonplace, done in all hospitals, all the time, all across the country. I had a case recently where a patient came in, I came on shift, the patient had been put on a breathing machine prior to my presentation to the ER, and the family came and called the geriatrician and said they never should have been put on a breathing tube, they had a do not resuscitate order. And the family was not in the hospital at the time, the geriatrician was sitting next to me. And to give you an idea how commonplace it is, the geriatrician said to the family, well, I'm within an earshot away, she goes, you're absolutely right. We need to disconnect the patient from the respirator. Dr. Reichman is on call. When you come into the hospital, just ask Dr. Reichman, and he'll be happy to disconnect the respirator. So I turned to the geriatrician, and I said, I'm sorry, Dr. Reichman will not be happy to disconnect the respirator for you. This is not something which is halachically appropriate. Now, this is what we saw with the feeding tube before. This is what a respirator, now respirators are, this is just one of many respirators. They're much smaller, much more compact, much more sophisticated. This is the device which delivers artificially. I will just share with you that while it is absolutely prohibited to disconnect a patient from a respirator, that's on the proviso that when you disconnect the patient from that respirator, it will inexorably and with certainty lead to the patient's death. there are circumstances where you can remove the patient from a respirator and it will not lead to the patient's death. So that's something that has, so there is a common misconception that everybody connected to a breathing machine, if you pull out the breathing machine, they're going to die immediately. It's absolutely not the case. There are many, many people who are put on a breathing machine who don't necessarily need to be on that machine. They can be safely weaned off that machine with medical guidance, and that's something that needs to be discussed on a case-by-case basis. But for those, and this I mentioned just so post-chem are aware of this, that even if a patient is on the respirator, and the halacha is you cannot disconnect the patient from the respirator, it still may be permitted to adjust the respirator to different settings to allow nature to, in a certain sense, to take its course. So while if you disconnect the patient from the respirator, it may indeed, Rishus Harav, well, indeed, it may, when, if you, I'm sorry?
Does this inexorably mean that this procedure?
So this, now if a patient will inexorably, it'll inexorably lead to death when it's clearly usher to, is prohibited to remove a patient from a respirator. But if a patient is already on a respirator, and again, this is something that needs to be discussed on a case-by-case basis with the POSIC and with the physician, the respirator may be able to be adjusted to decrease the work of the respirator, so to allow the individual to, or the disease process to take its course with little intervention as possible. Now this is a very complex matter. I just mention as something you may want to discuss, definitely needs to be discussed with the physician and with the postic. I do want to share with you something which has not received halachic approbation but was introduced in Israel, because some of you may have heard of this, is that the notion of using timers on respirators. Back in the 1970s, I believe, that Tzitzel Yezer mentioned the concept of using a timer on a respirator. And while the secular community does not really machalik, does not differentiate between withholding and withdrawing care, we in the halachic community have a very strong distinction between withdrawing and withholding. Withdrawing is considered a maisa biyadayim, it could be considered an act of homicide, a maisa ritzicha. There are certain things that can be done that are more indirect, which are less halachically objectionable. Some may be halachically permissible, some may be halachically less objectionable, depending on the scenario, depending on the circumstance. So the thought was that if you take somebody who needs to be put on a breathing machine, and you put them prospectively on a machine which is going to stop in 10 hours' time, and you reassess that patient at that 10-hour period of time, is that halachically appropriate? And then you can decide at that stage, do we reconnect the ventilator, do we not reconnect the ventilator? But the bottom line is the individual has not done any action to disconnect the ventilator. So that's something also which some post-scheme have allowed it to be used in very limited circumstances. But the objective here is to decrease the halachic objectionability of a maisa biyadayim. And as we conclude with our last few comments, pain management at the end of life, is it permitted to provide morphine for patients? And I know our next presenters will be discussing this in more detail, but just to share with you the halachic analysis, people are often petrified that if they give narcotic medications, they're going to kill the patient. And is this a justified fear? Is this not a justified fear? So the answer is that the post-chem are almost a consensus across the board that if your objective is to alleviate the pain and suffering of a patient, even though the morphine in this particular case may cause suppression of respiration, may possibly lead to death, it is absolutely permitted to perform or to administer the morphine under the following guidelines. One, the intent is purely to alleviate suffering and not to terminate life. Two, the dose of medicine is gradually increased as necessary. And three, administering known lethal or toxic doses is clearly usur, even if the stated intent is to alleviate suffering. And in fact, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, whom probably many of you remember, in his defense, in his legal defense, time and time again, said, all I wanted to do is alleviate the suffering of the patient. That was my kavana. The problem is, he gave potassium chloride to alleviate the suffering of the patient, and that potassium chloride is 100% fatal. So that's clearly usur.
What if there's a possibility, that if you're administering for suffering, that there's the possibility of death?
Not only is it mutter if there's a possibility of death, if the person, Rahmanul Islam, dies, if you administer that medicine to halacha, you are not guilty of ritzifa. There clearly is a risk. That's the point. There's a risk. You're allowed to administer it even though there is a risk, as long as you follow the parameters and follow the guidelines. And finally, active euthanasia, is it permitted to do as Dr. Kevorkian did, to end the life of a patient? And here you have a cartoon of a woman being accused of killing her husband, and she says, it was assisted suicide, but he was too pig-headed to ask for it. So the bottom line is, and here we'll quote the Ksav HaKabbalah on the Pasuk of Achas Dimchem Nafsho Seichem Ed Rosh Miad Kol Chayad Rishenu Miad HaAdam Miad Ish Achiv Ed Rosh Nefesh HaAdam, where he famously says that there are two types of Ritzicha, there's two types of murder. There is violent murder from an aggressor, from an enemy, and there is murder, no less considered murder, from someone who is your friend, someone who is your ish achiv, from your brother, someone who loves you, whose sole intent is to put you out of your suffering. And they love you so much, they want to see your suffering end. But the suffering, in order to do that, they have to take your life actively. It's absolutely usur to do. And he says, Lakachas mamono kadovav im l'tovas anirzach. Even if someone would prefer to die, this is no less considered ritzicha than the other form of ritzicha. So in conclusion, we have addressed some of the real-life issues that take place in the hospital, highlighting some of the issues, hopefully giving you some information that we should never address these kinds of issues, but should we need to address these issues, it will at least facilitate your ability to approach the posek and the physician in ways which are halakhically appropriate. Thank you very much.